First, I'd like to give you a very sincere word of welcome, especially if you've not been in St. Helens before. We look forward to seeing you again. We start again, actually, on January the 10th, and I'd be grateful if you'd write that in your diaries, on your cuff, or wherever it is, to remember to join with us on that Tuesday for our new series. And then would you look at the service sheet that you have, because 12 months late, I want to issue a word of gratitude. I'm not able to thank you for your generosity until a year later, but you were wonderfully generous last year to the two appeals that we had for our carol service, and you'll see the details on the yellow sheet in front of you. We're asking you to be generous again for the Shaftesbury Society and for the Muller Homes for Children, and you'll find the most gaily buckets outside, so perhaps as you go by you would aim your coins and notes into them and beat last year's appeal. And that reminds me to make one more appeal, if I may, before I start. And this really does come from the heart, because it's impossible to move in the parish offices at the moment. And one of the reasons for that is that the tape workers behind here have actually fulfilled every order given to them in the last month, and they would be very grateful if those who ordered tapes would come and collect them, and those of us who work in the offices would be even more grateful. So please come and take what properly belongs to you before Christmas. Now, prophesying about the future is, I think you'll agree with me, a mug's game. At the same time, telling what is going to happen in 1984 is immensely enjoyable, and in terms of journalists, irresistible. So that as you sit replete with your plum pudding and turkey at Christmas, reading whatever papers the NGA or anybody else will allow you, you're almost certain to read prophecies as to what is going to happen in 1984, hoping to be a little bit more accurate than George Orwell. For example, the financial journalist will tell you exactly what is going to be the share of the year. The fashion writers will tell you, ladies, what the hemline is going to be. Perhaps I've got the phrase wrong, but whatever they have to tell you, they'll be telling you. The political writers will look to Central America and tell you what they think Reagan is going to do. And the sports writers will major, no doubt, on the future of Watford and Arsenal if they don't pull up their socks, and so on. And I find nothing more pleasurable than to read those articles, that I always wish every Christmas that I'd kept the articles of last Christmas so that I could check up as to whether they were anywhere near right in their prophecies. Yes, prophesying the future is a mug's game. But it's not a mug's game if you're God. And the reason for that is, of course, that God knows the future. And therefore God makes a point, or made a point, of prophesying the future when he caused the Bible to be written. And you won't be surprised that if this is God's book that I have here in the pulpit, that it's full of prophecies. And during the Christmas season, one of the things we do is to look back to those marvelous prophecies, many of them written and spoken 7 centuries before Christ, and see how wonderfully they are fulfilled in the coming of Jesus. Now, our study on Tuesdays during December has been just that. We've been looking actually in Isaiah 9 to that great passage that was read by Chris as the first lesson for our carol service, about a light in the dark places. And it talks about one who's going to come, who's a wonderful counselor, a mighty God, an everlasting Father, and a Prince of Peace. And today we come to the end of that prophecy, and I've only got one verse. I knew I wouldn't be able to have very much because of the shortness of time at our carol service. But let me read to you the last part of this prophecy, spoken by a man who was told his message by God, a God who knows the future. Concerning this coming king, God says this, "Of the increase of his government and of peace, there will be no end, upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness, from this time forth and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this." Now that prophecy actually still has to be fulfilled. It is the prophecy of an everlasting kingdom founded on justice and marked by peace. I don't know if you were listening to yourself singing, but you were singing about it, I had forgotten that, in one of the early carols today. You were saying that one day there would be a kingdom like that, that with the ever-circling years comes round the age of gold, when peace shall over all the earth its ancient splendors fling. I don't know whether you meant that. But that is the prophecy, that one day there will be a world like that. Only the Bible says that it will be entirely supernatural. It will come down from God out of heaven. It will never be built by man and by politicians on earth. Of course, there were some idiots in the late Victorian era who believed it would be built on earth. I call them idiots. It's rather rude of me, because they were some of the cleverest men of the time. And if you'd been alive in 1883, and if you'd listened to the philosophers of those days, you would have heard how the 20th century was going to be the day when the kingdom would actually come. Only it wasn't a matter of Christ's lordship, but man's lordship. I have quoted this before, but let me quote to you Songs of Praise, 1925, this hymn. I nearly put it actually on the carol sheet. I nearly dared to ask you to sing it, but I thought there'd be a rebellion. But it's an astonishing thing, and I want you to listen while I just read a couple of verses, an astonishing thing that dear church people have stood up in church in this century and actually sung this hymn. Listen to it and see if you could. This is about the kingdom that man is going to set up. These things shall be a loftier race than e'er the world hath known, shall rise with flame of freedom in their souls and light of science in their eyes. They shall be gentle, brave, and strong, to spill no drop of blood, but dare all that may plant man's lordship firm on earth and fire and sea and air. Can you stand just one more verse? Here it comes. Songs of Praise, 1925, J. Addington Symonds. Nation with nation, land with land, unarmed shall live as comrades free, in every heart and brain shall throb the pulse of one fraternity. That outstanding nonsense is written in one of our main hymn books and is sung by many people still. That's not the prophecy of the Bible. The prophecy of the Bible is a new heaven and a new earth ruled over by Jesus Christ, and it is to be God's work. It is to be the result of God's zeal. Now, obviously, you don't believe any more in a kingdom built by men. At least I hope you don't. But do you believe, do people today believe in a kingdom built by God in the future? And I'm afraid the answer to that is no, they don't. So let me tell you what people do believe today. It's been a great surprise to me, but a friend told me yesterday that his daughter was the only child in class who did not believe, when asked by the teacher, in reincarnation. The only child in the class. So I quickly got hold of my dictionaries, and I found that reincarnation has probably been held by the majority of human beings who have ever lived. I remember a famous airman on Desert Island Disc saying he believed it. Apparently more and more people do believe it. It's one of the oldest doctrines in the world. Ancient Britons believed it before Christianity came to these shores. It's the doctrine of the transmigration of souls, that on death my soul is born again into another person's body. And the reason why people can believe that is because there is a deeply human conviction, an ethical conviction in all of us, that justice must prevail somehow in the end, and that if men have been evil, well, they'll be born into an animal, and if they've been good, they'll be born into I don't quite know what. Now, let's just for a moment get it clear what the majority of our fellow men, if the Gallup poll is right, believe. They believe in the transmigration of souls. They have a vague idea that after death, their soul will find another body, and therefore, listen to this, and therefore come back into this world. Now, I worked that out with regard to my father. It would have been that my father was born again into the body of a baby, and it might well have been a young, rising journalist who a day or two back was in Herod's men's department, sensed a story, walked out of the back gate, and was blown to smithereens. Or a relative of yours, whom you will meet round the Christmas tree, you may have met round the Christmas tree in days by, but now is dead, might have been born again into the soul of that lovely Alsatian dog that had to be put down. Now, if I could listen to the souls of that beautiful dog and the fine young journalist as they were about to migrate again into another body, I think I should hear a conversation like this. Forgive me if I'm fantasizing. As their souls were just about to be put into another human being, I think both would say, "Don't let me go back into that world, please." That's what you believe if you believe in reincarnation. You mean that you will come back into this old world of ours, which does not sing with the angel songs of peace, as we all too clearly know this week. What a hopeless hope. Now let me tell you, what is the Christian belief as I finish? God has a better program. His program is a threefold program. I will simply list it for you. First, God has ordained that there should be a ruler with all power in heaven and earth who can be trusted with all authority and who shall bring in this new supernatural kingdom at the end of time beyond the resurrection. So that in what is to me the loveliest of all the Christmas stories, which comes actually before Christmas, when the angel comes to the Virgin Mary and tells her what is going to happen, he actually quotes from that prophecy which was read to us just now. He will be great. He will be called the Son of the Most High. The Lord God will give to him the throne of his father David, and he will reign over the house of Jacob forever, and of his kingdom there will be no end. So that the Christian claim is that that king with all authority, who will be the ruler of this everlasting kingdom, who will have all world government in his hands at the end of time, that that king is none other than Jesus of Nazareth, whose birth we are celebrating at Christmas. That's the first of the Christian claims and the first part of the Christian program. Second part of the program. This rule, though rejected, of course, by man today, will return. That is to say, although we crucified that Jesus Christ and would not have him to reign over us, he is coming back to establish his kingdom. Does that sound strange to you? Well, if you were brought up to go to church and you said the creed in church, you'll have said that creed which has been said by Christians all down the ages and all through the world for 2,000 years. He shall come again with glory to judge both the quick and the dead. It's good that Prince Charles believes that part, isn't it, this morning? And his kingdom shall have no end. So all that Prince Charles was saying yesterday is simply a reflection of the Christian creed. He will judge every man, not just bombers. And as the end of that judgment, there will be a kingdom, and that kingdom will have no end. And that kingdom will be marked by what? Peace and justice. And don't let's kid ourselves. There's an awful lot of sentimentalism at Christmas. The Christian claim has never been that the coming of Jesus at Christmas time will bring a peaceful world, because the Christian story says that we rejected that king, and therefore he has handed us over to ourselves to run the world, and that if we run the world, there will never be peace, and there will never be justice finally, and there will be no peace and no justice, whatever philosophers tell you, until the end of time. There hasn't been so far. There never will be. That pessimism is part of the Christian creed. So you better get ready for the future. There's going to be a future shock every year. First part of the program, God has ordained a ruler. Second part of the program, this ruler, though rejected by men, is going to return in glory to judge all men and to set up his eternal kingdom beyond death and beyond space and time. Thirdly, here is God's program. Thirdly, very important for you to understand this. Those will be considered fit for that kingdom who have submitted to the king now. That's the point. Submitted to the king, in other words, when it's hard to submit. It won't be difficult to submit on that great day when Jesus comes, surrounded by myriads of angels. Why, every city man will be volunteering then to be a member of that kingdom. But that's not the issue, is it? The church is sent into the world today. The Tuesday pulpit at St. Helens stands for this particular challenge, that the king is alive today. He's been rejected by the vast majority of this world, alas, But he still commands all men everywhere to submit to him, to turn back to him. And if that sounds rather a frightening command, those of us who have done so would want to tell you that it's the happiest life in the world. Not always easy to bow the neck, not always easy to do what we're told. But when we do what we're told and follow Jesus, it's life worth living, and it's a hope worth having. Because of the increase of his government and of peace, there will be no end. Upon the throne of David and over his kingdom to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. It's lovely to be told by a girl who is a Jewess this morning when I came into church that she's submitted to her Messiah today. This, I don't know when it was, in the last week or so. Isn't that a grand thing to know? Because that's the throne, isn't it? It's the throne that came from David, that is established for Jesus Christ, and that will reign forever and ever. And I love that last sentence, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. If it was up to us, it would fail. But it isn't. God has committed himself to it, and God never fails in his purposes.